Thanks, Tom. Thank you very much for the invitation, for giving me the opportunity to present this paper in this place. So I will talk about what you all hate, taxes. And basically, I will present an extension of the Merton, the very classical Merton investment problem, to the case where we allow for capital gain taxes. So this is a joint work with Mette Sonner from Koch University and Imen Bentahar, she was my former student and she's now doing a postdoc in Berlin. Okay, so let's start. I would like first to review the Merton model. I'm sure everybody in this room knows very well the Merton model, but at least this will allow me to fix the notations. And there are a couple of things that I need for the rest of my talk. So the situation is very, very simple. Actually, we cannot make more simple than this. We have a non-risky asset which delivers some constant interest rates R. So the price starts from 1 and then moves by an exponential as usual. And then we have one risky asset. So one risky asset which dynamics are driven by the so-called Black-Scholes model. Here again we cannot make more simple than this because this is the simplest continuous time stochastic process with continuous path and with positive, which is positive, so we just take log normals. This is really the simplest example. Okay, so now in this financial market what we can do is trading and consuming. So we put part of the wealth as investment in the risky assets, part as investment in the bank, and we have to eat something in between. And this is the well-known evolution of the wealth process in this model. So you have, so I'm denoting by Z bar the wealth because I will have another Z in my problem. So the bars pertain to the Merton model. So you have the evolution of the wealth, you have the interest rate part. So you get an interest R. You have to subtract what you eat minus CT, and then this is what you get from trading. Okay? And another way of writing this would be this one, where I'm just replacing B minus R divided by sigma by the so-called risk premium theta. So this is the so-called risk premium in this model, and this is the very classical dynamics of the wealth process in this very simple model. So we take conditions on pi and C so that all these equations have good mathematical meaning. And then the optimal investment problem, which was formulated by Merton back in 71, is written here. Maximize the expected utility of consumption in infinite horizon. So it's really even simpler. So the investor lives forever and eats forever. And we want to maximize this quantity over choices of consumption and investment strategies. Well, this problem is very, very simple to solve because one can observe immediately that we have this homogeneity relation. Why is that true? Well, because if you multiply everything by some constant lambda, instead of having $100, you have lambda times $100, then clearly you would multiply everything by lambda, and that would be optimal solution of the problem. So because the utility function is of the power type, z to the p divided by p, then the lambda goes out from here to the power p and to the power p to the power p here. Okay? So it is clear right from the beginning that in this problem we have this homogeneity property, and since this is a one-dimensional problem, because of this homogeneity property, we are basically reduced to dimension zero, which means that we just have to find a constant. So this is why this problem is very easy. We just need to find this constant V bar of 1. How much is V bar of 1? This is the only thing we are left with. So to find V bar of 1, there are a variety of methods. This is one of them, which was used by Merton in his 71 paper, write the Bellman equation corresponding to this problem. So this is very classical in stochastic control theory. And now you plug this form into the Bellman equation and you realize that the z to the p cancels out, of course, because there is justice in life. You know that the solution is z to the p and that the value function satisfies this equation, so the z to the p should work. And then you find exactly what is the constant by this equation. So it's really very easy to solve. Okay, and then you can put it rigorously by using a verification argument. So, summarizing, this is the result from Merchel 71. We have an explicit solution for this problem. We have a certain condition which ensures that the value function is finite. And under this condition, we have an explicit expression of the value function, so z to the p times a constant. And the constant, I'm writing it as a function of interest rate and the risk premium theta, gamma of r of theta. So this is a very explicit function. Okay? And we also know that the optimal strategies are explicitly known in this model. So you have to invest a constant proportion of your wealth in the risky asset, p bar, which is given by this quantity. And you have also to consume a constant proportion of your wealth at any point in time. Okay, so this is well known, and I want just to remember these notations, the gamma and the V bar. So V bar is just z to the p times gamma, and gamma has this explicit form and depends on the interest rate, and theta depends on other parameters, but this is the main parameters it depends on. The other parameters, this beta and p are parameters of the utility function. Okay, now I want to formulate a problem of optimal investment with capital gains. So first I have to explain what I mean by capital gains. As you all know, the tax code is very complicated. There are many definitions of taxation. It can be very complicated and can differ from one country to the other, and even in the same country it can differ from one individual to the other. So I will formulate a very precise definition of the taxation rule. So in order to calculate the tax to be paid, basically, when you sell one unit of risky asset, you sell it at some amount. So you sell it at the price of the market, PT, at that time. So you have to compare this PT to some index, BT index, or we call this a tax basis. So you compute this difference, and this is going to define your capital gain or your capital loss for the tax administration. And they will base your taxation on that difference. Okay? So now what is the definition of the tax basis? Now here there are many possible definitions, and I am listing here a certain number of these definitions, and I will, in the rest of my talk, I will concentrate on this one, the bold-faced one. But let me just discuss the other ones. In the previous literature, the first definition was by Diblig and Kuh back in 96. There is a preprint which is never published, which never has been published. So in this preprint, Diblig and Kuh consider the problem of optimal investment in discrete time in the binomial tree. So they just take binomial tree. So uncertainty is very, very simple. You start from S0, S0U, S0D, etc. So in this binomial tree, and Diblig and Kuh were looking at what happens in the investment problem when the uncertainty is defined in this way, and when the tax basis is, in fact, what happens is that every time, so your portfolio is this box, and every time you buy an asset, you put it in this box. And you have to record now the price at which you have bought it. So this one would be 100, this one 105, this one 82, etc., etc. And what Diblig and Kuh do is that whenever you want to sell one asset, you have to pick one little ball from this box. You read the price, and this is the ball that you're going to sell at that price. And this defines the BT. So you choose whatever asset in your in your portfolio, and you decide that this is the asset that you're going to sell, and you compute the PT minus BT corresponding to that asset. So this was the problem which was formulated by Divig and Koo, and as you see, this is a very difficult problem because it is infinite dimensional. You have to record all your portfolio, but you have to record the details in your portfolio, so all the prices of the assets that you hold in your portfolio. So it's infinite dimensional, and indeed in that paper by Divig and Koo, they did numerical computations for 4 periods. And they could not go beyond 4 periods. Beyond 4 periods, the computer could not calculate in real time. So this is the only result that they have, 4 periods, and then, of course, they try to answer some economic questions, what happens if such parameters is increases, etc., etc. But you see that the numerical complexity is really, really high here. They could not go beyond 4 periods. And then I will jump to this paper by De Miguel and Upal. So these people are at the LBS in London, and these are people in OR, and they had a trick in order to increase the speed of this algorithm, and they were able to go up to 10 periods. Could not go further than 10 periods. So this is an infinite dimensional problem, so the number of periods explodes very quickly the computational time of the solution. So this is the first rule. So choose whatever asset in your portfolio. Now there are other rules. This rule I have been working with Elias Vigny and Pierre-François Coll in the past on this rule. So in this rule, we choose you are not allowed to choose any asset in your portfolio. You have to choose the oldest one, first in, first out rule. So you can imagine that it is even more complicated than the Divig and Koo problem, because now you have to record not only the price but also the date at which you have bought it. Okay, we had two papers, mathematical papers. We proved the existence, but we had nothing at all in terms of quantitative results. We could not say anything on the solution, so that was disappointing. And actually, I went back to this problem because I saw Stathis Tompidis. He's in Texas University, and I was visiting there, and he was presenting a paper on this subject. And actually, he was presenting an extension of this paper, Damon, Spat, and Zong. This is a paper in the Review of Financial Studies, 2001, and Stathis was presenting an extension of this paper to many assets. And what they do in this paper is that they consider the following taxation rule, which is in fact the taxation rule in Canada. So taxation rule in Canada is you have to take the average purchase price of in your portfolio up to the current date. So this is a very large simplification. So instead of recalling all the numbers on the little balls, you just have to recall the average. And especially when you are familiar with stochastic control, when I saw Stathis Tompidis presenting this, I said, wow, this is exactly what we have to do, because the mean is a Markov variable, because you can update the mean in a Markov way. So from the point of view of stochastic control, this is very good, because this is going to avoid the infinite dimensional problems. So what I'm going to present today is an adaptation of these ideas. So these papers were written, again, in the binomial tree model, in discrete time. So I will present an adaptation of this model to the continuous time framework. And I will present, I will show you that we can say something on this problem now. I want to say two other things on this average purchase price. This paper by De Miguel et al., where they could go up to 10 periods in the Divig Koo problem, there is a very nice result, numerical result in this paper, because what they show, they compared different taxation rules. What happens for the investor under different taxation rules? And what they showed numerically with different sets of data, what they showed is that, in fact, the average purchase price up to the current date rule is a very, very good approximation of this infinite dimensional rule. So, in fact, when you do the computations, numerically you find very close results. So, this average purchase price up to the current date can be seen either as the rule in Canada, but also it can be viewed as an approximation of these infinite dimensional problems. So, since I am in a business school since September, I have to be a good citizen, and I have to make sure that we understand everything with numbers. So, let's see how we compute this average price tax basis on an example, so that everything is clear. So I'm taking an example. You have different points in time, and you make some decisions at these different points in time. B means buy, so 5B means you buy 5 assets, 1S you sell 1 asset, 2B you buy 2 assets, etc. Okay? So this is what you do through time, and I am recording what I call Y. Y is your position on the risky assets in terms of dollars. How many dollars at each time T you are investing in the risky asset? So if the price of the risky asset is P, Y divided by P is how many shares of risky assets you are holding in your portfolio. So N is the number of shares. And the tax basis B is computed as follows. So remember the definition, this is the average purchase price. So you only have to average out the purchase price. Sales, the sales do not alter the basis. Okay, so basis starts here. You have bought 5 assets at time 1. So the basis is P1 up to time 2. At time 2, you sell 1 asset. It keeps its value at P1 because it is not altered by the sales. Okay? Now, at time 3, you buy 2 more assets. And then the new basis now is changed to the average between these 2 purchases. So 5P1 plus 2. You have bought 2 assets at time 3, so 2P3 divided by the total is 7. Now here you sell 5 assets, so the basis is not altered. We keep the same basis. And here you buy 2 assets, you average out again. And you see that, well, these numbers 7, 9 describe in fact the total number of purchases that you have. Yes? What goes from 5 to 4? The number of assets. The number of assets. Yeah. It goes from 5 to 4. Why do I have 7 in the denominator? In here? But this is the definition. This is the definition. You have to average out the prices, the purchase prices. So if you sell 1, it doesn't matter, you still count with 5. Well, the reason is that, suppose you go here. Now here you sell 5. So which one are you going to subtract? From which date? This is the reason. If you allow such rules, then you do not know how to dispatch these 5 assets. So the rule is sales do not alter the basis. You only average out purchases. Okay, is that clear? Yeah. Yes.
Speaking, I don't think that's exactly how it works in Canada. So in Canada, when you compute capital gains, you need to adjust the cost base, which is the total amount you pay or redeem divided by the number of shares you hold. So it's true that sales will immediately affect the your basis.
Okay, I took this from this paper of Damon's Pat and Zong, and it might be simplification because you cannot exactly take the tax code is always very, very, very complex. So maybe it is a simplification of this, but this is exactly what they were considering in this paper. So you average out the purchases. So I don't like these 7, these 9s, because these are the total purchases, and what I observe in my portfolio is how much I'm holding. And how much I'm holding is this number N. So it is very easy that you can recover the N in the denominator if you subtract now the sales, but evaluate it at the average. If you subtract something evaluated at the average, it would not change the average. This is the idea. So it's a very simple idea. And what you see here is that now in the denominator we recover this NT at time T. Now the BT at time T is, in this formula, it is in the denominator is NT, and numerator purchases minus sales evaluated at the basis price. So this is going to be the definition, and let me jump straight away to formalize this. So these are the notations that I explained before, and now I will start to explain the controls for the problem. So I will denote by DLT the amount of purchases of risky assets. So these are transfers from the bank to the risky asset account. So these are how much money did you put on the table in order to purchase assets between T and T plus DT. This is DLT. And now for the sales, I take it in proportion of your position in the stock, because I'm going to avoid short selling. So in proportion of your position on the stock between time T and T plus DT, YT DMT, this is how much you sell. So these are all definitions. And with these definitions, the variation of your position on the risky asset account is first the variation which is due to the variation of the prices. Amount divided by price is the number of shares times the variation of the price, plus what you got between time T and T plus DT, what you bought. These are the purchases. So it comes with a plus in your position on the risky asset, minus what you sold, what you sell between T and T plus DT. Now, the tax basis, as I discussed before, this is 1 over NT, and this sum in the numerator, I call it KT. So state variable is going to be KT. I would forget about the BT. So 1 over NT KT, and as we have seen before, the variation of KT, what do I add between T and T plus DT? Well, I add my purchases, DLT, and I subtract my sales, but evaluated at the basis price. I subtract my sales, evaluated at the basis price, so that the basis is not changed by the sales. So the sales are YT DMT. I want to evaluate YT DMT in terms of the basis price, so I divide by the price. This is how many shares I have sold. And then I evaluate these number of shares in terms of the basis price, BT. Now, if you replace BT by KT divided by NT, you get this formula. So, very nice linear formula. So, the dynamic of this variable KT is DLT minus KT DMT. Okay? Now we have... Let me before discuss... So, we have this... capital gain or loss, what this is how much you have sold, YT DMT, minus this is how much you have sold, minus now you have to compare this to its value evaluated at the basis price to determine the tax. And its value evaluated at the basis price again, it is the amount divided by the number of shares. This is a number now evaluated at the basis price. So you get this linear thing, YT minus KT multiplied by DMT, and you see that you have a capital loss if Y is smaller than K, and you have a capital gain if Y is greater than K. And in this model, I will, as in Damonstrat and Zong, I will allow for tax credits, actually even more than tax credits, because I will allow that if you have a capital loss, the government will pay you money straight straight away, immediately. So the taxation rule is, we have a tax rate alpha, a constant tax rate alpha, say 30%. So when you sell the amount YTDMT, in fact what you get is YTDMT minus the amount of tax that you pay. And the amount of tax that you pay is 30% of your capital gain or loss. Capital gain or loss is calculated there. So we get this formula. This is how much you get from your sales between time T and time T plus DT. Okay, any question? Yeah, it breaks everything, but okay. It is already very complicated. We spent 3 years on this paper. But it is definitely, this is the direction one has to look for. Okay. So let me summarize everything now. So our state dynamics is a triple S equals XYK, because P naught and P simplify in this problem, because we have just a Black-Scholes model, coefficients are constant. Now we have transfers, so this is the sales and the purchases and sales. And the sales are expressed in terms of proportion of the position in the stock. The wealth on the bank is, first you get an increase due to the interest rate. Now you have to subtract how much you consume. You have to subtract your purchases minus DLT, because you take that money from the bank. And you have to add up what you get from selling. But when you sell, instead of getting YTDMT, because of the taxes, you get this 1 minus alpha Y plus alpha KDM. So this is what we saw before. This equation we saw before also. This is just the evolution of the wealth on the risky asset account. So this is what happened because of the market. Number of shares times the variation of the price. This is, we have new shares coming up because we purchased shares. We have bought some new shares. And we are selling some shares, YTDMT, so these disappear from the portfolio. And the tax basis is, actually it's not the tax basis. The tax basis is 1 over NT times KT. So the dynamics of KT is this one, DLT minus KTDMT. We put a certain number of conditions. First, we want to put the solvency condition. Solvency condition means that at each time, you have to be solvent in the sense that if you liquidate the portfolio, then you have to have positive wealth. And if you liquidate the portfolio at some time T, then you have to pay taxes. So if you liquidate the portfolio, you don't get X plus Y, but you get X plus this quantity as usual, exactly as before. This is what you get after you pay taxes. This is the after-tax liquidation value of the portfolio. Now, second condition that we want to put is a no-short sales constraint. So we want the position on the stock to be non-negative. And this is due to a paper by Konstantinides back in 83. So what Konstantinides showed is that, if you allow for short selling in this problem, then the solution is very easy. You just exercise losses immediately, whenever you have losses, and you defer gains forever. If you can always go negative, you just defer gains forever, and therefore the problem of taxes is meaningful only if you put a constraint on the position on the risky asset. Okay, so this is the problem now. We have exactly the same problem as in Merton, infinite horizon, expected utility of consumption. We want to maximize this over all strategies of investment and consumption. Admissible strategies. Admissibility is defined by the restrictions that I have put in the previous transparency, so solvency condition and no short selling. And we want to solve this problem. Okay, so this is the state space that we are working in. Is we want the position of the stock to be non-negative. The basis is non-negative, and we want the Z, so my notation for Z is always this one. This is the after-tax liquidation value, so this is X plus the average between Y and K. Okay, so this is the formulation of the control problem. What can we say on this problem? Well, we have the same condition as in the Morton problem, which ensures that the value function is finite, and we have this property 2 is also is trivial. If you increase one of these variables, x, y, or k, then the value function increases. If you increase x, you have more wealth in the beginning, so you are better off, of course. If you have more assets in the beginning, also you are better off. This is positive wealth also. And if the k parameter is higher from the beginning, then also you are better off, because it is going to be higher all the way around, and you're going to pay less taxes, in fact. So you have this increasedness property, but usually, for people who are familiar with these investment problems, usually what happens is that in these problems, you maximize this concave function, and usually you inherit concavity. The value function is concave, but in this problem, we could not show that the value function is concave. And indeed, I will show you in the numerical result that the numerical results seem to say that it is not concave. Okay, so it seems that the value function is not concave, but this is bad for us, because concavity implies continuity, so you have a little bit of regularity you can work with. So we have really to work without any regularity. If you start on the boundary of the solvency region, this is the boundary when z equals 0, then basically you have to stop there. You cannot invest in the market, because the Brown emotion will drive you out of this region. So the value function, you can prove that the value function is 0 straight away. You have the same homogeneity property than in Bradshaw's model, than in the Merton model. And therefore, you gain one dimension if you want to do numerics. Instead of three dimension x, y, k, because of this property, you have two dimensions. And as I said, we have no regularity. You can prove, this is not very difficult to prove, you can prove that it is optimal to exercise capital losses immediately. Whenever you can get something from the government, you just get it. So this is what is called wash sales. So this is optimal in this model. And now I'm coming to the main result that we have. And let me explain the intuition for this result. So remember this process Z, which is the after-tax liquidation value of the wealth. This turns out to be very important, process Z. So you can very easily compute the dynamics of Z, and this is what you find. So you find that the dynamic of Z, remember that I called Z bar the dynamics of the wealth in the Merton problem, and this one is Z. I did this on purpose, because Z looks very much like Z bar. Look at Z. It looks very much like the dynamics in the Merton problem. If you forget about the green guy, forget about the green part. If you forget about the green part, then, and if you replace 1 minus alpha y t by pt, then this is exactly the dynamics of the Merton problem. So, in particular, what this says, since the green part comes with a minus sign, k is positive, remember, this means that in this problem with taxes, you are always worse than the Merton problem, because you have this minus all the time. Okay? So this means that your wealth is always greater, is always smaller, I guess. This should be smaller. The wealth is always smaller than the corresponding wealth in a Merton model, because in the Merton model, you don't have this minus. Okay? And so this is very natural, of course, because this is what you want to say from the beginning. This means that in this problem with taxes, you cannot do better than in the problem without taxes. Okay? Now this is shown clearly from the mathematical point of view, and you could doubt about this fact, because remember, you can get money from the government, because the government gives you money whenever you have capital losses. So you may think, maybe I am so clever that I would take advantage of the generosity of the government, and I would get money from him every time I lose money, and maybe I can avoid giving him taxes. So this shows that, no way, the government wins. You cannot do better than that. So The second formulation, alternative rewriting of this dynamics, so this is just a triviality, passage from here to here, just rearranging terms. If you rearrange the terms differently, then you can have also these dynamics, which look very much, again, as the Merton dynamics, but with different parameters, sigma alpha and theta alpha, where these parameters are just the parameters in the original model deflated by 1 minus alpha. So sigma is multiplied by 1 minus alpha and b also. So this is the new risk premium parameter and the new volatility parameter. So if you forget about the green guy, you have exactly the same dynamics as in a Merton problem, but with modified parameters, with deflated parameters. Now, the idea here is to say, in contrast with the previous formulation, in here you don't know the sign of k minus y. K minus 1 is positive or negative depending on whether you are in a situation of capital gains or capital losses. So it could be both, it could be positive at some place and then negative, etc., etc. So you don't have a sign for this, so you cannot just obtain one inequality. But the idea here is to say, what if I can make sure that this difference is very small? If I can make sure that this difference is very small, then I would be able to compare my value function to the value function of the Merton problem with modified parameters now. Okay? And this is exactly what we do. So this is the intuition, and these are the main results. So the first result is that our value function is smaller than the value function of the Merton model without taxes. And second result, our value function is bounded from below by, so remember, this is exactly the value function of the Merton model, the constant times z to the p, but now the constant is evaluated at theta alpha. So this is the value function of the Merton problem with deflated parameters, sigma times 1 minus alpha and b times 1 minus alpha. So this is the lower bound that we have here. And now we have a nice byproduct of these two results. Well, I am writing the two bounds again on the first line, and theta alpha is the risk premium, the original risk premium, which is minus this amount. So this is a smaller risk premium. And as you can realize immediately, now if you look at these two bounds, and you look at the first order expansion of these two bounds in terms of the pair R alpha, then you find exactly the same first order expansion. If you do it only in terms of R or only in terms of alpha, it doesn't work. But in terms of the pair R alpha, we have now this first order expansion, because if we have the same first order expansion on both sides, we have it for V. Now this is the corollary that we have, is that function V has an explicit first Taylor expansion in terms of the pair R alpha. Okay, and we can, out of this first order expansion, we already can observe some properties that we expect from the economic point of view. Okay, so in the remaining time, what I want to show you is that this approximation is in fact a good approximation. So we have to compare it to the value function, and the problem is how to compare this complicated value function. So how to compare this complicated value function? I will go through the Hamilton, Shackley-Lieberman equations, etc. But before, let me make this comment. I forgot about this comment. So as I said, in the intuition to obtain the lower bound inequality was to ask the question, can I make this guy small? And this is exactly what we do in the proof. In the proof, what we do is that we construct a sequence of strategies which imitates exactly the optimal Merton strategy in the deflated market. So this is exactly we imitate. So the proportion of wealth invested in the risky asset is very close to P bar, up to 1 over n, and while keeping this difference smaller than 1 over n. So this is exactly what we do. So now, in view of this first order expansion, this sequence can be seen, can be viewed as a maximizing sequence up to the first order. This is optimal up to the first order because it achieves the first order expansion. Okay, now, Bellman equation. I know no other method to produce something on this value function, so you can prove that value function solves some Bellman equation. Bellman equation is very ugly in this problem. It is a variation inequality, and this variation inequality comes with this vector field, G2, here, and G2 has a very bad property because if you look at it in the plane YK, it is not locally Lipschitz here. So we have a lot of technical problems at that point. We have to use, we have state constraints, Y positive and K positive, so we have to use constraints, viscosity solutions, semi-continuous envelope because we have no regularity at all, and we can prove that we have that V is a constrained viscosity solution of this complicated equation, and for this complicated equation we have to introduce transaction cost in order to ensure uniqueness, otherwise we could not prove any maximum principle without transaction cost. So we, unfortunately, I don't like to mix imperfections, so here we already have taxes and we had to introduce this transaction cost. This is very artificial, just for the equation to make sense. We could not do something else. Okay, so we have existence, we have uniqueness. In fact, I'm cheating a little bit because I don't have time. We have to do some approximation to have this. Okay, so we can work on this equation. We can produce something out of this equation. And now I will show you some numerical results with these values of the parameters. So you don't have time to look at these values, but these are the typical values in the financial market, and these are the same values as in the paper by Damon, Spat, and Zong, because we wanted to compare to these papers. And we're taking values of interest rate, which range from 0 to 7%, and the parameter alpha of the tax parameter from 0 to 30%. So we want to see how accurate is this approximation. Okay, now I have to open another file, which is here. Okay, so we solve this variation inequality using finite differences and the Howard algorithm. And then, so we have three dimension x, y, k, and because of the homogeneity, we have two dimensions. This is why you will see later on that we have two, not in this graph, but later on, you will have only on the plane. So what happens is that you solve for each value of the parameters, you solve on a grid, and you get values for the value function everywhere. Okay, then I take my first order approximation, and I take the relative difference at each point, and then I am plotting here the mean relative error. So the mean is taken over all the grids. So when you do it over all the grids, you get a relative error which can jump up to 25%, which is too much. And then what you can do is, now the error is too big, so let's look inside the grid. How is the error distributed? And without surprise, what you find is that when you approach the boundary of the grid, the error just explodes. This is what you see here. So what we did is, now I look at this figure. Now in this figure I am writing the average relative error, but now inside the grid. I take only points inside the grid, and now the average relative error is of the order of 4%. So which is really good, because we're taking realistic values. Alpha equals 30% and interest rate 7%. These are realistic values. So I will just show you two graphs and I will stop here. So one of them, I can show you this kind of graph. So this is the value function. As I said, you normalize by liquidation value equal to 1 because of the homogeneity, and you are left with two dimensions. And you see that the value function is neither convex nor concave. So it doesn't seem to be to have a concavity property. And now we can also say something on the optimal controls, what happens in this problem. So this is typically what happens. This is a typical kind of result. Oops. Can I zoom more? No, I can't. Okay. So typical kind of result is that what happens is that you have a bang-bang behavior. Okay. Yes, thank you. Okay, so you have a bang-bang behavior. As for people who are familiar with transaction costs, you have a region, the black region is a no-trade region. So in this region, you don't do anything because you fear taxes. You don't do anything. You just leave your portfolio living as it is. In the gray region, you buy immediately, and in fact, you reflect up to this region. So this is a local time type of behavior. And in the white region, this is the sell region. When you are in this region, you immediately sell and you reflect on the black region. Again, this is a local time behavior. So this is the kind of results that you obtain in this problem. Okay, I think I'm already out of time, so thank you very much.